The president wants to spy on 200 million Americans without a warrant. Has he read this document, which he has sworn to uphold?
Now, I will not have you libel Abraham Lincoln.
I don't understand the problem with registering guns. We register cars.
Mark Levine brings you the news the government doesn't want you to know.
Today, an explosive story about connections between white supremacists and Islamic terrorists.
When there's a conflict between Scalia's conservative values and the Constitution of the United States, he throws away the Constitution.
When we do have secret prisons, that is not what America's all about.
Let's go to Mark in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to The Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine. Today, Pearl Harbor Day 2009 seems, well, quite a far away from 1 year ago. Do you remember December 2008? The economy was in free fall. We had the greatest loss in the gross national product since the Great Depression. And in this Bush Depression, not only was unemployment rising, but the deficit had already reached a peak at that time of more than $1 trillion. We had the financial markets frozen. Credit was so frozen that the Federal Reserve indeed panicked a bit and did what it could to get us to, get the markets working again. Now, 1 year later from December 2008, 10.5 months into the Obama presidency, well, things have changed a good bit. The economy has already come up from its worst. Unemployment has taken us down a tick. And the question is, should we do more? Soon after the Bush Depression hit the winds of December 2008, the Democrats begged the Republicans, we need a stimulus package. And of course, George Bush refused, preferring to, while this time, saying goodbye to everyone. But 2 months later, after Obama was president, we did have a stimulus package. And you may recall what happened even then. Not a single Republican vote for the package in the House of Representatives, and the Republicans in the Senate, the two main senators that would sign on, insisted that they'll only have stimulus if there was less aid to the states. So, what do? Obama had no choice. The Republicans were filibustering. He cut back on aid to the states, forcing states across the nation to raise taxes and cut spending at a time of massive unemployment. Do we need another stimulus package? I think so. But my guess is my guest does not. He is a frequent guest here on The Inside Scoop. Mike Lane, welcome.
Mark, thank you. Good to be back.
Well, Mike, you heard my rendition of history. I think that we need more stimulus. Frankly, I think we needed it back in February. But specifically, I'd like to use money from the TARP program. There's 100-some-odd billion left, and use it for stimulus. And I'll tell you specifically what I want to do with it. I want to give it to the states so that states across the country don't have to balance their budgets by raising taxes and cutting spending at a time of depression.
Well, Mark, I'll say one thing. You're consistent. You did say last February to me,
yes,
on
I
this
did.
Program that the stimulus was not going to be enough. I argued that it was way too much by about two. I think times have proven me right. It was too much. It's increased the deficit. It sucked money out of the economy. It squeezed private borrowing out. There's no room for private expansion. Businesses are uncertain as what the future economy is going to be because of the deficit spending, and they're not investing in job creation and things like that. So a new stimulus program is the last thing we need to do. But let's talk specifically about your idea in the TARP. There's no legislative authority to use that.
No, we're going to need a bill. I recognize we're going to need a bill.
I don't know the president recognizes that we need a bill. I think the president thinks that he can just take this. Actually, it's more than a little bit over $100 billion. It's actually $200 billion they have left in TARP. And I think he thinks that he can just go ahead and spend it on programs that were discussed at the White House Jobs Conference last week.
Well, there is wide range in the TARP. It depends exactly on what. I think there are some things it could be used for. Mm-hmm. I would prefer to have congressional authority. You know me. Got my Constitution in my pocket. I prefer to do things by the book, and I prefer that whether it's a Democrat or a Republican in office. But at the end of the day, you say the stimulus package was too big.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean we're in great economic times that you think?
No.
Frankly, I mean, let's be clear. If the stimulus package had been half as large as it was, unemployment would probably be 11-12% by now.
The stimulus package has killed jobs. It has killed investment.
Stimulus Look, killed jobs. Explain that to me.
Well, first of all, because it was not a stimulus. We were told there was going to be $1 trillion for shovel-ready projects.
$700 billion.
$734 billion, whatever it is.
That's a big difference. $700 billion
and $1 trillion. Oh, $250 billion among friends. What's that? The point is, we were told it was going to be for shovel-ready projects. In fact, there were no shovel-ready projects in there. We still have spent just marginally less than half of the stimulus money 11 months into the whole thing at this point, or 10 months into the whole thing at this point, where are the shovel-ready projects that we were promised that was going to happen? Instead, what do we get? We get a White House website that tells us about 34,000 jobs that were created in the 34th Congressional District of Arizona. And we all know that Arizona only has 6 congressional districts.
Yes, the webmaster made a mistake.
This is the White House, Mark.
The White House webmaster did make a mistake. It wasn't a mistake like outing a CIA agent, what Dick Cheney did. It wasn't a mistake like, oops, we forgot about Katrina, 1,000 people died. Some webmaster in the White House made a mistake. I say get a new webmaster.
And Obama says he stands by the 36th District of Arizona.
No, he doesn't.
He says he stands by it.
Well, maybe the webmaster said so. Here's the thing, Mike. You and I both know that there were not enough shovel-ready projects available back a year ago.
Then why did we fund it that big?
Because
let's leave the money.
We knew
the
that there would be projects in the next 2 years. Some of the projects did come online this year. Some will come on next year, and a few left to 2011. If we had put them in a bunch of, Keynesian filling holes and undoing the holes, I can just hear the Republicans now, $700 billion wasted on projects that weren't even real projects. We wanted to do real things that would help real people. That means that some were shovel-ready in 2009, some in 2010, some in 2011. But the problem is that unemployment is just starting to go down. These things take time. We need a bigger stimulus. We need a bigger stimulus then. You cannot deny, or maybe you can, that the reason why Virginia and virtually every state that requires a balanced budget is going to have to cut spending massively at the state level. That means laying off teachers, laying off police officers, laying off all the things that states provide, and or raise taxes in order to balance state budgets. That shouldn't have to happen. The government should at least be able to do that. The federal government can print money. State governments cannot. This is the time we need to print money.
Mark, I have no sympathy for the states. Let's talk about the states that are in the worst shape, okay?
California.
And Michigan.
Run by a Republican governor.
California and Michigan, I don't care who runs them, they both have the highest tax rates, they both raised taxes in the middle of the recession.
They had to! Party forced them to!
No. Let's talk about the state that's in almost the best shape, Virginia, where you and I live. No tax increase,
yeah,
no discussion
Governor
of
Kane,
tax increases.
There's a Democrat.
We have reduced spending by 15% in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and we have one of the best economies in the country today.
Yeah,
that's the formula for doing it.
Well, I agree that Governor Kane did a tremendous job, but we have needs that your Republicans in the Virginia House haven't paid for. For example, we have transportation needs right here in Northern Virginia, but oh no, we're not going to pay for that. The thing is...
No, things are going to wait, you know, because things are going to wait. I mean, there are Democrats' favorite mantra is we have so many unmet needs.
That we do.
Well, you know what? We're not going to meet every need, and we're certainly not going to meet every need in the next 12 months. What we're going to do is we're going to prioritize. We're not going to have a job-killing, recession-extending tax increase. We're going to get the money into the private sector and let the private sector, not the government, drive us out of the recession. And when we do that, then we can sit down and start addressing your unmet needs.
The reason why states are raising taxes, the reason why states all across the nation
states
are not raising taxes. Cutting budgets.
Virginia's not raising taxes, and it's one of the best
economies
in the country.
I'm talking about the 50 states, and I agree that Tim Kaine did a tremendous job as governor of Virginia.
Why can't every other governor not raise taxes?
Because the 50 states across the nation, at writ large, not just Virginia, are raising taxes, and they're cutting spending, and they're doing so in the middle of a recession, because the Republicans insisted that the stimulus cut aid to the states. I say we need more, but I've got a caller, and I want to see what he thinks.
All right.
If you want to join in, by the way, it's 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. George from Fairfax, welcome to the Inside Scoop. George, we don't hear you.
Can you hear me?
We hear you now. Talk to us.
Something must be wrong. I'm agreeing with Mike here for some reason.
George!
No!
George, be still my heart.
No, and I'm disagreeing with you, Mark.
All right.
There are two things. This business with giving the money to the state, I think that's wrong. Because the state, the political side of it is going to bleed off so much money, by the time it gets down to the people who need it or can use it, there'd be practically nothing left. What it needs, and George Bush demonstrated this, was when you give a tax cut to the lowest income group, that money immediately gets circulated through the economy, and there was a stimulus when George Bush did that. So So for some reason, again, I'm agreeing with George Bush on
Now, let's be clear about a few things. First of all, I have no problem with giving a tax cut to low-income groups. You may recall it was Bernie Sanders' idea, our one socialist in the entire United States Congress. George Bush signed on to it, one of the few good things George Bush did. But for the states, George, if you don't trust the money will get to the people, then basically you're saying you don't trust the 50 state governments. Some are better than others, I'll grant you. By the end of the day, because states can't print money under the Constitution, they can't print money because we'd have 50 state monies, and because it's hard for some of them to raise money, it means that states have to act counter-cyclically. In other words, the federal government, in hard times, can print more money, can stimulate the economy, and in good times, they can run surpluses, like Bill Clinton did in the 1990s. States don't have that freedom. Most of them have a constitutional requirement to balance their budget, and that means they have to raise taxes or cut spending in hard times. I can't think that you, George, would think that's a good idea. George, you there?
I'm losing you. Yeah, I'm losing. This phone isn't real clear, but one other thing I wanted to add.
You didn't hear what I said. Okay, go ahead, George.
The other thing I wanted to add was is this healthcare cost amounts to a significant tax on everything that we export. When the aggregate cost of our healthcare insurance is $2.2 trillion a year, as opposed to most other countries, which run about 11% of their GNP.
So you support healthcare insurance
about $800 billion a year unnecessarily on what I call excess profits to the healthcare industry.
Okay, so
if we ran it efficiently, we could save about $1.4 trillion a year.
So
that would make it so much easier for us to export and therefore balance some of our economics.
Okay, so to be clear, George, you do support healthcare insurance reform, right? I don't know if he can hear me. Apparently, I can only hear him, and he can't hear
yeah,
me.
Yeah, I think he said his phone was
clearly
intermittent.
Does.
Right.
All right. All right.
I'll stipulate. George has called him before. I'll stipulate that he supports healthcare reform.
Okay. Let's talk about his first point. Now, George, I want to give Mike a chance to respond.
Hang on, George. Should have.
All right. Hang on. I want to give Mike a chance to respond to his point on the stimulus, because apparently he agrees with you.
Well,
I guess I don't have to. Maybe you don't have to respond then.
Yeah, I mean, there was a bounce from the Bush stimulus, which was the instant rebate back to all consumers,
which
and most of it
by
got
the way.
Spent. And it was, you know, it actually gave us a 3% boost in the economy temporarily one quarter. It was spent and it went away. And
so
that's
you were
the problem
against
with it.
That part of the Bush agenda.
I actually thought at the time it was good, but it did us a temporary bounce, and it didn't give us a permanent bounce. And, you know, we're looking for the permanent bounce. The permanent bounce is investment by small business in their own businesses for expansion and job creation.
Let me suggest
that's
to you
where the end of the recession is at.
The permanent bounce would be taking away the things that caused the problem in the first place. When we come back, I want to talk about financial regulation,
which
why I
deficit
support
spending.
Obama's regulating the Wall Street people that got us into this. I want to hear what you have to say, too. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. What do you think about the Fed? Find out after this.
This is firstgov.gov, where we're obsessed with getting you government information.
Brand new student loan applications on the site, baby.
This calls for a celebration.
Here's your uncle.
So in the end, it was either take the astronaut gig or come work here. What can I say? Duty called.
Dude, that's my cop.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. No, I'm pretty sure that's Sam's cop.
Oh, sorry?
Yeah. No. Sam's. No.
Just log on or email us and get what you need.
C, change of address form. That's how it's done.
D, driver's license renewal.
E, emailing social security information.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Nice, we'll allow it. All right, Ed.
What are those?
Government surplus cars for auction.
You posted those online last time.
No, you did.
I'm posting them online this time.
For all your government information, firstgov.gov.
Oh, what have we got here? Sometimes you feel tired. You can't seem to lose those extra pounds off your midsection. And your joints hurt when you take the stairs. Well, you're getting older. But I'm happy to say that there's some simple things we can do to keep you happy and healthy for years to come. We can also lower your risk for some serious diseases the older population is often subject to. Proper nutrition is more important than ever. Your body has changed, you know. Not as many treats. A basic exercise plan. Lots of walks and fresh air. And most importantly, come and see me for twice yearly checkups to help ensure the best possible quality of life. Now, how does that sound? Good boy.
Improve the quality of life for your elderly pet. Schedule twice yearly checkups that include preventive care and regular lab work. A message from the veterinary members of the American Animal Hospital Association.
Here again, the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Looking at today versus 1 year ago, of course, the other big change is that a year ago, we were in a massive credit crisis. We had a credit freeze. Banks weren't even lending to each other in the United States. And we had very large corporations that were too big to fail. AIG was deemed too big to fail by both the Bush administration and the Obama administration. After all, their business is or was in one-third of all American companies. Should we allow corporations to be that big, where they can pose a systemic risk to the economy? The president says no. Democrats agree. And while Chris Dodd and Barney Frank are doing different fixes, the whole idea is not to allow the same thing to happen again. Meanwhile, Ron Paul, Republican, Libertarian, and Democrat Alan Grayson, a strange mix, are trying to audit the Federal Reserve. I want to know what you think and what Mike thinks about both of those. But for you to call in, the toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Mike, first financial regulation before we get to the Fed. Should we regulate companies so they're not, quote, too big to fail, unquote?
You're asking the question the wrong way, I think.
All right.
You know, it's not should we regulate companies so that they're not too big to fail. I mean, you have a dichotomy here, particularly in the financial services industry, where if you want to be a global player in a global marketplace, you have to be huge because you can't compete against state-owned corporations in the Middle East, you know, the Bank of Dubai, places like that, which it has unlimited funding, cost of capital is absolutely nothing, and they are the ones who are grabbing market share and financing the major projects. If you want to be a major player, the way Citi used to be and the way Bank of America used to be and aspire to be again, then you've got to have banks that are huge.
But the problem with Citibank is that the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which I think is one of the few government programs you agree with me works pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Depression-era program. The banks pay some amount of insurance away,
insurance, right.
And then they, in essence, pay for the failed banks. All the banks in America, through the FDIC, pay for the failed banks. But Citibank wasn't just being a bank. Citibank was doing brokerage services, investment services. AIG, even more, was using credit derivative swaps, these crazy things that, frankly, no one could even evaluate. So some people made hundreds of billions of dollars, and meanwhile, we taxpayers had to pay for it. At the end of the day, we had to do a bailout. Both Bush and Obama thought so. Otherwise, the whole economy is frozen. I'm sure you don't think that should happen again. How do you prevent that from happening?
Well, I don't know that, you know, the bailout, first of all, I reject out of hand the hysterical allegations. I'm not saying you just made it. You might want to make it. But the hysterical allegations that we were on the verge of complete and total collapse going into a depression.
That's what the Federal Reserve Chairman said?
Right.
That's what Bush's Treasury Secretary said?
Bush's Treasury Secretary was dead wrong about it. Bush was dead wrong about it. The chairman of the Federal Reserve was dead wrong about it. They created the hysteria more than the marketplace
Here's what they told us. And Obama's
people are dead wrong about
it.
It was not as bad as they're saying it was.
Now, as you recall, you supported it at the time, and you changed your mind.
Why are we recovering? Why are they saying TARP has served its purpose after 1 year when it was authorized for 2 years and they're looking for other ways to use the money if it was indeed as bad as they say?
I don't think they knew exactly whether it was a $600 billion problem or $800 billion problem. My understanding is they thought it was a $14 trillion problem, and you had to give more bank reserves because, you know, 5% of bank reserves can lend out to 100% of money. So they didn't know exactly the size of the problem. But we do know what Hank Paulson, Treasury Secretary under George Bush, said at that time. We know what Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said at that time. They said the credit market was frozen. That you had overnight rates that were some 6% higher than the Federal Reserve rate. That had never happened before.
Mm-hmm.
You had banks refusing to lend at all, not even to other banks. We had not seen a credit crisis like this since the Great Depression. And financial crises often lead to extended depressions, as we learned from 1929. Now, you call this hysteria. Apparently, they convinced George Bush, but it's not just George Bush. I don't think you'll find a single, maybe you can name one, a single reputable economist in the nation, including conservative economists, who will tell you we were not in a massive credit crunch. Now, maybe the TARP should have been $500 billion instead of $700 billion. You can argue that. But to say we shouldn't have intervened, we shouldn't have saved AIG, I don't know any economist that says that.
No, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have intervened. There were clearly areas for intervention. I'm not sure that I agree in retrospect with the intervention in AIG.
Would you have let AIG go bankrupt? It's involved one-third of American businesses in some way or another.
In retrospect, I would have let AIG go under. The programs that they had would have all been picked up and bought by other businesses that, you know, could have picked it up for 10, 20 cents on the dollar and made a fortune out of doing it. AIG as an entity did not need to exist. There was no moral cause to keep them
involved. There wasn't a moral cause. There was a financial cause. They had their finger in one-third of American businesses. You would have had one-third of American businesses suffer uncertainty. That's, 100 million businesses?
But 50 million businesses? But temporary uncertainty, because if AIG had to liquidate all of their assets...
Through bankruptcy court? You think one bankruptcy court could have handled massive monstrosity that was AIG?
We did a bankruptcy on GM in 60 days. In, out, clean, sweet, done.
AIG was a lot bigger than GM and had a lot more complicated... GM, as far as I know, didn't have credit derivative swaps to deal evaluate.
So let's say it took 90 days for AIG.
So you'd be willing to make one-third of all American businesses be uncertain for 90 days. You don't think that would cause massive economic problems?
I think we're still uncertain, and we're uncertain for reasons of government doing right now, and that uncertainty has lasted 10 months, and it's going to continue for years at this point, the way the government is pursuing its program. Yeah. So
I'll tell you this. Franklin Delano Roosevelt did shut down the banks for a bank holiday for about a week. He didn't shut them down for 90 days. I don't think you can shut down the American economy for 90 days.
No, I don't think. No, shutting down AIG would not shut down the American economy.
It would come close.
And not
one
shutting
third
it down,
of the American economy.
Letting AIG fail because they deserve to fail because they
Let
were
me tell
irresponsible.
You this. They did deserve to fail, and they should have failed. And I want a system in place whereby people, namely corporate executives, that mismanage businesses in the way that the ones that did AIG fail, I want them to pay the price. I want them to lose not only all their corporate assets, I want them to lose all their personal assets too. And if I could find any reason to stick them in jail, I would. We have to have a law first before we can do that.
No, you can't do it ex post facto.
No,
but
you
I'm
can't
sure,
do it ex post facto. The Constitution prevents me, and I respect this. I want to. I didn't say I would. But the point is, we can't let this happen again. Now, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke was one of the big proponents of this bailout. He's up for renomination. Do you think he should be not renominated? If so, you agree with Socialist Bernie Sanders on this
one. I didn't realize that Bernie and I were in the same basket on this one, that Bernie Sanders should not be
He put a hold on the nomination.
Reappointed.
He's requiring 60 votes.
That may or may not be something that Harry Reid from Nevada, the majority leader, is able to get around. Here's my problem with Bernanke. Number one, I disagreed with him on the hysterical nature that he portrayed the credit crunch. I think he overdid it in an attempt to get what he wanted, and you have to have faith with the American people and not overdo it.
He convinced George Bush, Dick Cheney, President Obama, John McCain, Clinton. Major player at that time that disagreed.
Yeah, I don't know that he convinced Cheney. Cheney went along because he was a good vice president, but I don't know that he convinced
John McCain
Cheney.
Was certainly convinced.
Bush. And mistakenly so. A permanent black star on John McCain's record for going along on that one. But here's my big problem with Bernanke.
I don't know that Milton Friedman, but you can name any conservative economist.
Here's my
I don't
big
know
problem.
One that opposed it.
Here's my big problem with Bernanke. The Obama administration came to town saying that they were going to champion open, transparent government, and they really haven't done the job, I don't think. That might be an argument for another time, but nobody can argue that Bernanke has not fought transparency at every opportunity, every turn. The inside of the Fed is still a secret society. It's like Skull and Bones up at Yale or Harvard, wherever it is. Nobody knows what they're doing. They refuse to tell anybody. The art of the Fed, is going to go nowhere because they won't cooperate. These people think they're their own government. It goes back almost to the hysterical nature. I'm not buying into this, but it goes almost back to the hysterical nature 20 years ago of people who said, well, what's this sneaky international group, the Trilateral Commission, that secretly runs the world and stuff like that? The Fed is not transparent. Nobody knows what they're doing, and they need to be held accountable. Bernanke is the one who's fighting that. For that reason, he needs to go, and we need to get somebody in there that is willing to be transparent.
I'm going
to
say something extremely unpopular, and I fully admit that you've got all the riders and torches and horses with you on this one. It clearly, the populist idea is abolish the Fed, and Ron Paul...
I don't want to abolish the Fed.
Okay.
I'm saying
make them so weak that they can't do
it. Let's shine some light in there. Let's find out what they're doing.
the Federal Reserve began because of a series of panics in the late 1800s and early 1900s. It actually predates the Great Depression, though it didn't have much power until after the Great Depression. It began because of the Panic of 1897 and the Panic of 1906, because at that time we had to rely on people like Andrew Carnegie for our money supply rather than...
A great American, by the way, Andrew Carnegie.
Not when we rely on a single individual to control the nation's money supply. The Fed serves a very important purpose. They regulate the money supply, and I like that it's independent. As I hear what you're saying, Mike, you want Congress to control the money supply.
No.
You want Congress to... Here's the thing. The Federal Reserve keeps very detailed notes. They release them, depending on which thing they're doing, for the monetary supply. They release their meetings 2 weeks after the date. They don't do it the moment of, because we all know that can make markets go haywire. They wait 2 weeks, then they release it. Ben Bernanke and every member of the Federal Reserve is able to be called up at any time in front of congressional committees. He goes, he testifies, he answers questions under oath. I don't know of him refusing to answer any question. He's required to tell where the TARP money is going. They've laid it out. It's easy to blame the Fed, but as far as I'm concerned, although I disagree with the Bush administration using the TARP program without any kind of oversight, the Obama TARP has had oversight, and that was the best way to do it. I understand it was an emergency for Bush, but the Federal Reserve makes its decisions in secret. That's the way it should be. I know that's terrible to say, but that's the way it should be because it keeps the markets from going haywire. 2 weeks later, it's out, and every single thing they say 5 years later is on the record based on the Freedom of Information Act. This is a necessary secret.
5 years later, you know, that's not good enough. I want to know who's getting the TARP money now, and we're not finding that out. We're not even finding it out 2 weeks later
We don't know who got it under Bush, because the legislation that gave the TARP money under Bush did not specify accountability. I think that legislation was wrong. It should have specified accountability. But the second TARP, the one under Obama, did specify accountability. You can go to the Federal Reserve website and say that these banks have gotten so much. They don't do it by bank. They do say the banks in general or this
right. area. I want to know who's getting it.
Yeah, but see, if you know that a bank is getting more money than another bank, that can lead to a run on the banks, right? I mean, if you know that, and I'm not saying it's true, that Citibank is in more trouble than Bank of America, then you have massive depositors running from Citibank to Bank of America. These kind of bank runs are exactly what led to making the Great Depression worse.
Well, agreed. But if you're going to take TARP money, if you got yourself into this situation through your own fault, and your own fault could be that you got swept up in the whole thing and you didn't have enough reserves to protect yourself against this, that's your problem. And if it leads to the failure of your bank because you're going begging for government money, I think I have a right to know where that's going.
It's okay for the failure of small banks. The problem is these banks are too large, too big to fail. When we come back, I want to talk about legislation to fix that very problem. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Back after this.
Osama bin Laden calls getting nuclear weapons a religious duty.
Today, materials that can be used to make nuclear weapons are stored in more than 40 countries.
Sometimes protected by just a chain-link fence.
Yet not enough is being done to lock down these materials
before terrorists steal them. Why did we learn all this?
My mother.
My son.
My sister-in-law.
Were all murdered September 11th.
Help protect America.
Together we can.
Please join us.
The stem cell issue is being debated throughout the country. Truth is, most everyone has an opinion, even if they don't know the facts.
Let's stop arguing and start really understanding the potential of stem cell research.
For us and for millions of Americans living with disabilities, get the facts.
Call 1-877-842-3442 for free information from the Stem Cell Research Foundation. That's 1-877-842-3442.
Following the tragic events of September 11th, there have been hundreds of violent attacks against innocent Americans.
Remember what that flag you're waving stands for.
Remember, please stop the hate.
We're stronger when we are united.
Remember. Remember what that flag you're waving stands for.
One nation under God.
Indivisible.
With liberty.
And justice.
For all.
In America, there's either room for everyone or it's not America.
Don't pick the wrong fight.
Let's keep America land of the free.
Stop the hate.
Planning a home renovation? Put this at the top of your to-do list.
Because after 10 years, none of you are protected against tetanus and another potentially fatal disease, diphtheria.
A minor injury, such as a cut or a scrape, can put you at risk for a tetanus infection. And while safety gear offers some protection, an up-to-date vaccination, called the TD booster, is the best insurance against tetanus. So get the TD booster. If it's been 10, do it again.
Here again, The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine. There are many, many things to discuss with my guest, Republican strategist Mike Lane. I want to finish up the topic of financial regulation and then move on to Copenhagen, Afghanistan, and a few other things. On financial regulation, my point is this. You may not have agreed with the bailout. Most economists, including conservative economists, thought it was necessary. Leaders in your own party, John McCain, George Bush, thought it was necessary. It seems to me that I don't want to be in this situation again. And the one thing I think you and I can agree on is we never want a future instance where taxpayers have to come in and bail out financial firms for making really stupid, risky bets with what turns out to be our money. We both agree we don't want this to happen again, right?
Well, first of all, let me admit that a year ago as we were discussing this, I was not as hostile to the bailouts at that time as I have become in retrospect, because
right.
I've seen how they've worked, or more likely, in my opinion, how they haven't worked, and that's why I don't think they were the right thing to do.
At any rate,
yes.
We both don't want it to happen again.
Right.
All right. Now, I will give you my solution, and in fact, it tracks. There's some legislation by Chris Dodd in the Senate. There's some legislation by Barney Frank in the House. They differ, so I'm not quite sure where this is all going to pan out. But it seems to me, in order to prevent businesses from being too big to fail, like Citibank, they didn't want to let go under because it was such a big bank with so many branches all over the world that they thought it would cause massive damage to the United States economy, to the world economy. One thing you can do is have a bigger FDIC, one that controls, we already have the FSLIC, the FDIC that protects savings and loans. We already have a protection for SIPC, that's for securities. Mm-hmm. We need more money, more insurance. If banks are going to engage in this behavior, they need to put a lot of money away to protect us against them having problems. And at the end of the day, if we ever have a firm that is so large that it poses a systemic risk to the entire economy, we have to regulate it and prevent that from happening.
Mark, I'll meet you halfway on that. Any insurance program needs to generate the premiums necessary to cover potential losses. I mean, that's the definition of what insurance is. So if the FDIC is an insurance program that protects consumers against their bank failing, then having an examination of the practices and what those banks are doing and what their risks are and assessing them premiums based on the level of risk of their activities generates enough money into the insurance pool to cover potential losses. I have no problem with having that discussion.
It's more than banks. As you know, when the Glass-Steagall Act ended, that wonderful act from the 1930s that separated a wall between banks and brokerage companies and so forth, suddenly everyone got involved in unregulated markets, specifically credit derivative swaps, this idea that you're betting over whether someone else is going to fail, and these horribly unregulated things. Can we agree these things need to be brought on the books, they need to be open, they need to be regulated, they need to be disclosed, and if you've got an institution that is betting too much, that institution can be closed or can be forced to say no. Just like a bank has to have so much reserves, you can't bet that much.
Okay.
Don't go to Vegas billions of dollars.
I'll go with open, on the books, transparency, risk assessed, all that stuff. I don't know that we have to regulate them.
But we regulate banks today.
If we know what they're doing.
We require banks
right.
to have a reserve requirement.
Right.
And that's 5% or 6%. The idea is if you go and you want your money from the bank, you can get it because they're required to keep a certain percentage in the banks. It seems to me that if people are betting on credit derivative swaps or any other instrument, anything far greater than their net worth, or frankly, even 50% of their net worth, we can say, no, I'm sorry, it's like a reserve requirement. You can't bet
is
the
it,
farm.
Look, here it is. If it's on the books, and therefore it's open and subject to scrutiny, and people know what's going on, then if the risk is assessed and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation wants to assess them a substantially higher premium based on the risky nature of the activities that they're in fact, a premium
so high that they have to stop.
Well, not so high that they have to stop, but so high as to cover the potential losses of what they're doing, I'm good with that.
Well, I'll tell you this. To cover the potential losses of what AIG was doing, it would cost more than the entire worth of AIG.
Well,
which is exactly why AIG should never have been allowed to go that far.
Then they may have assessed the cost-benefit analysis and said, you know what, there's no upside to this compared to the downside. We're out of this market.
One other thing I'd like to see in financial regulation. AIG is, at least putatively, an insurance company. Insurance companies, as you know, are regulated by the 50 states, yet AIG was a multinational conglomerate. Mm-hmm. Let's say that either we have federal regulation of insurance, and I'm all for that, or insurance companies can only do insurance, not credit derivative swaps. They can insure farms and fire and cars, but they can't get involved into securities, and if they do, they got to be regulated by the SEC.
Well, I think the state-by-state thing on insurance programs is a past tense kind of thing.
So we agree, federal regulation of insurance.
We agree on that.
What do you know?
But it's a trade-off for getting rid of the state. You know, there's no reason why states should have insurance commissioners
and
all that stuff. No, we only need one level.
I think states can protect themselves sometimes even better than the federal government. Let me move on to a couple other issues. Copenhagen, the great conference on global warming is starting to happen now. And as you told me today, the Environmental Protection Agency has said that we're going to regulate carbon right here in the United States. I think that's great. I do want to see the cap and trade proposal. I think that's a better way to do it. The idea is, of course, that you have to buy and sell pollution offsets. As you know, an economist, I think that's the best way to do it. But it seems to me the EPA has every right to regulate any kind of pollution. And carbon, in certainly the quantities we've seen it, is pollution.
Well, Mark, you know, we talked before when we were discussing the TARP bailout about my list of the people who were wrong. Now I'll give you the short list of who was wrong on this one, and that was five members of the Supreme Court who 2 years ago decided that the EPA actually had jurisdiction to regulate carbon in the way that they're proposing
to
do it.
Is carbon not part of the environment that they can protect?
You know, what
clean air, clean water, is carbon not something that's in the air?
What
black soot, is that not part of the air?
What you're doing is five unelected jurists who sit on the Supreme Court pontificated, misread the Clean Air Act, and gave the EPA authority. Gave the EPA authority that the legislators who wrote, debated, and argued for and passed the bill never envisioned. They never thought that carbon would be regulatable under the Clean Air Act. The Supreme Court misread it and said it is, and now the EPA is on a march to destroy the United States economy for whatever reasons we can't figure out. Only to give the president a boost as he goes to Copenhagen for a conference that is collapsing under the weight of the East Anglia email scandals. And, you know,
rogue scientist,
look,
and suddenly global warming doesn't exist.
No, it's not one rogue scientist. It is this guy at East Anglia is the godfather of the whole thing.
Let's fire him.
Look, here's the thing.
Let's fire him.
Well, he's already been suspended.
Great.
But he's the one that has the data for 150 years. He's the one that said, oops, I'm sorry, we moved to a bigger facility and we threw all the data out to save room.
Look, I'll be the first to tell you that I don't like rogue scientists any more than I like, rogue governors of Alaska. The point is, he needs to follow the scientific method. If he doesn't do that,
he
should be suspended.
And
he should be suspended. But to suggest that the Arctic ice really isn't melting.
It's not.
It's not melting.
No, look.
Look. All those photos and images and all those satellite images.
They're mostly cooked.
They're mostly cooked.
You know those cute little pictures of the polar bears are
cooked. We're going to have to go up to Canada and check this out.
You know the cute little pictures of the polar bears are cute. Now,
temperature going up, all of that is cooked.
In fact, but that's the whole thing. That's what the email scandal has showed us that the temperature is not going up. And they were arguing among themselves in these emails about, oh my God, the data is not supporting us. Our models don't tell us why the data is not supporting us. We have to suppress anybody who wants to publish the fact that we don't know what we're talking about.
That is what the email said. Rogue scientist.
But
I'm glad he was suspended.
You know, here's
Let
what
me
we
ask
did.
You this. EPA is, you would agree it is their job to keep the air clean, right?
They have.
We can argue about what clean means, but it's their job to keep. At the end of the day, what you're saying is that carbon is not a pollutant, right? That's what you're arguing. That CO.
No.
You could put as
they
much
have,
carbon
no.
in the air
job,
as much
no.
soot from coal plants.
No.
It doesn't affect anyone's
no.
health. That's what you're saying.
Their job is not to keep the air clean. Their job is to protect consumers from unhealthful levels of pollutants in the air.
And what you're saying is that no amount of carbon can ever be unhealthful.
No, I didn't say that.
Why can't they regulate it?
Because what they're going to propose and what they're going to give the president as he goes over to Copenhagen for this conference that was collapsing of its own weight is they're going to come up with a standard that simply is not based in the science. It's based in politics.
Well, you know what?
And,
they haven't gotten to their standard yet. When they get it, you complain. At the end of the day, I think carbon is a pollutant. They have every right to regulate it. I want to move on to another topic.
The interesting thing on this last comment is first we found out that Al Gore invented the internet, and now we found out
Al Gore never claimed he invented the internet.
Now we find out he invented global warming as well.
Al Gore never claimed he invented the internet. He said he played a major role, and he did. Now, moving on to Afghanistan. This is an issue where, I don't know, maybe you are in full support of the president. Here you had President Obama turn against many of his allies on the left. He got, he should have gotten support from the Republicans. They were complaining. But in the day, he took a major political risk, and he did so because he felt after 90 days of a very close review, the 30,000 troops were necessary in Afghanistan. Frankly, I'm not sure he's right, but I fully admit that he has more data than I do. I sure to God hope he's right. I'm nervous. I think the Karzai government is corrupt. I don't know that it's fixable. I know Karzai's saying all kinds of nice things now. At the end of the day, if the Afghan people aren't on board, we're going to lose this thing. And I hope that this is not just more troops, but a real change in strategy. The president says it is. I'll take it at his word, but I'll admit, I'm kind of nervous on this.
All right, first of all, I'll step. Karzai is about as corrupt as it gets. But you deal with, you play the hand you're dealt, and we are dealt a partner who is a corrupt thug. And, you know, that's, you know, he may be a son of a bitch, but for right now, he's our son of a bitch, and
right.
We're going to have to play along
with
that.
How are you going to get the Afghan people to play?
Well, you know, I mean, there's ways of doing this. You know, we got them to play by sending the Marines out into the field and talking with the people and living with the people in Iraq. And hopefully,
and paying the people
and,
of Iraq,
and hopefully,
just be this,
you know,
little bucksheesh, well, little bit of money.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Walking around money may be the only thing we can do.
Let me give you the broad picture on this. The first is, I think that the president made the right decision, perhaps for the wrong reasons. He had boxed himself into during the campaign, saying
that was his promise. He boxed himself in that he had to do something.
Here's my problems. What does he know that the general on the ground doesn't know, General McChrystal, who said, you know what, I need 80,000 troops, and they said, well, that's not going to fly. He said, okay, I need 40,000 troops.
Actually,
and then Obama said, after 9 meetings with his war council, I'll give you 30,000 troops.
Well, Mike, as I think you know, McChrystal actually gave 3 separate troop levels to the president. He gave one at 10,000, one at 40,000, one at 80,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, anytime you give 3 numbers to someone, you fully expect him to pick the middle one. I think McChrystal wanted 40,000, not 80,000. I think you'll agree the 80,000 was his high scenario and the 10,000 was his low scenario. And he decided on 34,000 because, frankly, NATO is going to pick up the difference. And they should pick up the difference.
NATO's troops are nowhere near as effective or as good as
ours. They're sending about 7,000 troops.
To equate the quality and effectiveness of a NATO troop with the United States of America troops is...
You know, NATO's supposed to be pretty good. We've had this alliance for 60 years now.
Yeah, and we're there because...
And
we're there protecting them because they're not as good as us, Mark. Come on, you know that.
The toll-free number, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Feel free to join the discussion. We'll be right back after this.
One day these rats were playing in the woods. One gave back 5 seconds.
Exactly, from the left.
From the left.
I think Afghanistan. Don't play with fire.
Don't play with matches. Don't play with fire. Only you can prevent wildfires.
Fire! Why don't you just wash your car at home?
When I wash my car, everything runs down the street and down into the storm drains. With all the chemicals and the soaps and waxes, the last thing I want to do is poison my own drinking water.
At least here, it's all contained and recycled on site.
That's why I also take my car in for oil changes instead of doing it myself. I take a chance on spilling stuff.
You know what the best part is?
What?
More time to kick back and watch the game.
How far would you go to protect the planet?
I want you to build an ark.
Here we go! Okay, that's good. Oh, okay. Ow!
Maybe there's another way.
People! The flood is imminent!
Is it too much to ask for a little precipitation?
Go to fightglobalwarming.com to find out what you and your community can do to reduce global warming pollution.
C
Somewhere around the world, there are men and women of the armed forces risking their lives, helping rebuild communities after natural disasters, collecting toys for needy children, tutoring kids in school. These are your sons and daughters who work to keep us safe, secure, and free. Dedicated men and women who put their country first.
Here again, the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Of course, when President Obama announced his Afghanistan policy, I don't know, you'd think that the Republicans would cheer. But the thing they didn't like was he said that in July 2011, we're going to start to pull out. I happen to support that. I think that's good for a number of reasons. One thing, I think we've got to put Karzai on notice. He can't expect us to be funneling billions of dollars into his economy again and again and again forever. You know, the Afghanistan gross national product, the entire country, is about $12 billion, and we're going to spend at least $30 billion putting troops there. That leads to a lot of massive corruption. We had to let Karzai know there's going to be a date. And also, I think it's important to let the American people know there's a date. If this isn't working but by July 2011, we need to reevaluate the whole thing.
Mark, if it's not working, we're in trouble. Failure is not an option. We have to be there until we do the job. And I don't think that July of 2011 is enough time to do the job. We'll find out. So I spent some time in the Marine Corps. I am not in charge of this whole training program. But in my estimation, there is less than a snowball's chance in hell that we are going to have an Afghan army standing up ready to do the job by 2011. This is a 5 to 7 year process to train these people.
That it'll work in 5 to 7 years. To me, the answer in Afghanistan is a federalist solution. We got to work with the local tribes, the local warlords. We can make Karzai mayor of Kabul, that's fine. But Kandahar, you got to have its own local people in charge. And elsewhere, that's the only system that's going to work. I hear some inklings from McChrystal that that's what he's going to try to do. I'm okay with that.
I'm okay with that, too. But it's not going to happen by July of 2011.
You know what?
And I know this is just one of those areas where, let's face it, the president's trying to have it always. In order to placate his left-wing base, he says, well, we're going to do this, but we're going to start the withdrawal by 2011. And then his Secretary of State and his Secretary of Defense go on television the next Sunday, the Sunday we just saw, and they sit there on Meet the Press
and they say,
we're going to start the withdrawal in 2011, but we only withdraw one person a month.
At the end of the day, we won't be in Afghanistan if the political will in America is not to be in Afghanistan. You say failure is not an option. Failure was an option in Vietnam. I don't think even you think we should still be in Vietnam fighting that war. At the end of the day, the most important thing is to protect the United States of America, to make sure that Al-Qaeda does not attack America. It may be that this, I've often thought, and this is not something I've heard, this is my own speculation, that in many ways the Afghanistan troops are a ruse. We're going to stick them over the border into the parts of Pakistan where Osama bin Laden is. I hope we do that. And I know we can't say it out loud because the Pakistani government would be in trouble if we say it out loud. I hope that's where they're going because that's where the real problem is. Al-Qaeda is not near the problem in Afghanistan that it is in Pakistan. If we can help the Pakistani government, that's how I support the troops.
Right.
I know that's not something Obama said publicly.
Three or four things on the way out here. First, the head of the Taliban, not Al-Qaeda, said, you have the clock, we have the time. He'll outweigh us. Secondly, I agree with you that the troops will be in Pakistan. I mean, we don't have to, of course they're going to Pakistan.
This is our little secret, right?
Of course they're going to Pakistan.
Right. But
the Taliban is just as much a problem as Al-Qaeda
is. I don't think it is.
Because it was the Taliban that provided the safe camps for Osama bin Laden to do it. The last thing I'll say is Osama bin Laden is on record as saying that one of the reasons that he knew he could wage a successful fight against the United States was because we didn't have the time or the guts to stick it out, the stomach to stick it out in Vietnam, and that encouraged him to pursue his thing against us.
So you would still have troops in Saigon today.
I would do what I could to have prevented Osama bin Laden from taking us out on September 11th.
See, Mike, there's Taliban and then there's Taliban. And I really think there's a difference between the leaders like Mullah Omar, who I want to capture or kill or try and do away with, and the massive, I think some studies have shown, and Dick McChrystal says this, that some three-quarters of the Taliban in Afghanistan, they're not the leadership that invited Al-Qaeda in. They're people who are distressed, Karzai's corrupt. They don't have any kind of security. There's civil war in Afghanistan. So they turn to the Taliban for the same reason they turned to the Taliban 10 years ago to bring order.
Right.
I think the majority, three-quarters of the Taliban are just local officials and people who can be brought back into sanity. The hardcore, I'm as against them as you are. But I think we have to make a distinguish between the hardcore and the followers on, who I think can be helped.
If we can buy them off and bring them over to our side.
I think we can.
No, if we can, that's great. I have no problem with doing that. But remember, these guys are making a calculus. They have to be there for the next 30, 40, 50 years of their life.
That's true.
And they have to know who they're going to be playing with. And if we're moving out effective 2011, then the Taliban, the bad guys, are going to be there. You know, they play both sides of the fence until we're gone.
Which is why I'd support the local warlords. There's a couple other things I want to talk about. The Catholic Church, as you probably know, has denied communion to Representative Patrick Kennedy and some others. It depends where. It's a kind of a local decision, it sounds like. It's not like it's coming down from the Pope.
It's a diocese.
It's a diocese decision made by the local priest or bishop.
The bishop.
Yeah, you're a Catholic, so I shouldn't tell you how your system works. I'm going to surprise you on this one. I'm okay with it. Not because I think it's a good idea, but because I think the Catholic Church has every right to define who gets religious rituals. I would ask that they be consistent. If they're going to deny communion to Patrick Kennedy, they should deny communion to anyone who is pro-choice on abortion, and that may include tens of millions of Catholics across the United States. They should be consistent, but the idea that the Catholic Church can determine its own doctrine, that I support.
Mark, you got that part right. Now, as you stated in the beginning, the issue is that it's a diocese by diocesan decision,
right.
And each bishop decides, you know, who is.
And I think they have that right. I do.
And so, if you're looking for consistency from Rhode Island, where Patrick Kennedy is, to Kansas, to North Dakota, to Richmond, Virginia, you know, the same set of facts doesn't work. And
but the shouldn't bishop the diocese the facts. Deny communion to every single Catholic in Rhode Island that supports abortion? I mean, wouldn't that be the fairest way to do it?
No. It's to elected officials here.
Why only elected officials?
Because they're the ones that have the influence on it. They're actually casting votes to do
they're representing their public. The people that Patrick Kennedy represents are more pro-choice than pro-life.
And there's nothing, you know, that is their right, and it's Patrick Kennedy's right to accept that and to vote the interests and representatives of his district.
That's right.
But at the same time, it's not his right to present himself at the altar rail for communion.
No, that's true. Look, the Catholic Church can define communion however they want. I wish, frankly, they would stay out of our civil government, and I'll be happy to stay out of their religious affairs. I believe the separation of church and state. One person, though, who I think really should stay out of our affairs is the former governor of Alaska. I mean, I know she served 2 years there, or maybe it was 18 months. I forget how long she spent as governor of Alaska. Most of the time, as I recall, she was buying dresses on Republicans' dime in the vice presidential
race. You know, she has a section in her book, Mark, How to Look Like $1 million on a $150,000 budget.
Well, you know, poor woman to only have $150,000 for her clothing. You know, she should go to Goodwill. But one thing that struck my eye, it was in today's Washington Post, is that she is now saying, and I believe the Post on this one, that is okay, it is justified for people to look into whether or not President Obama was born in the United States. So I have a rumor that I want to start right here, and I must admit I have no evidence to back up this rumor. Sarah Palin, I believe, was born in Canada. She isn't from Alaska. She isn't from Idaho. She's from Canada. I know she's got a birth certificate from, I believe it's Idaho, from the United States, but Obama has a birth certificate from Hawaii. If you don't accept Obama's certificate, you shouldn't accept Palin's birth certificate. Unless we have actual film that proves it's on American soil, come clean, Sarah. You're a closet Canadian.
Well stated, Mark. You've got the producer and everybody else laughing. It was a well-done thing, but look,
it's as ridiculous to challenge Obama's birth certificate to challenge Sarah Palin's birth certificate.
She didn't challenge it. What she said was, and you can look it up on her Facebook page because that's where she puts these things, is that she thinks it's fair game to be looked into.
Well, let's look into hers.
And if you want to say that it's fair game to look into Sarah Palin's birth certificate, that's fine.
Well, we need to look into Sarah Palin's birth certificate. I think she's a secret closet Canadian put in here to take over our government. And soon they're going to have Alaska will be part of British Columbia and Washington State will go back. And, you know, I mean, she's out to take us.
Unlike the president, Sarah Palin, I'm sure, can produce an authenticated original copy of her birth certificate.
The president
can't
a year
do that.
Ago.
You know that. No. He has never produced a copy of a birth certificate. You know is that he's produced a certificate of live birth reissued from the state of Hawaii.
Not reissued.
Yes, it is.
It's issued.
No, it's It's not.
It's issued, and it has the date of issuance of his birth. And what I want to know is how is it that President Obama, that he actually had a birth notice of his birth on the day of his birth in the Hawaii newspaper, where is Sarah Palin's notice of birth in her newspaper? Mark. Obama has more proof he's an American citizen than Sarah Palin does.
That's fine.
She's a closet Canadian.
Then
she came in across the ice.
That's fine. Let's go argue that. So it's fair game. So we'll look into both of them, and we'll see where it comes out.
You know the irony of all this? John McCain actually wasn't born.
He was born in the Panama Canal Zone.
He was born in the Panama Canal Zone, and there is an argument to be made that he is not a natural-born citizen. That's actually a serious argument. It can go either way, but Democrats didn't have the indecency to even bring that up.
Well, you know what, Mark? I think it's fair game to look into Sarah Palin's birth, and it's fair game to look into the president's birth.
You can look into it all you
myself,
want,
no,
but once you have authenticated proof, you're done.
But we don't have authenticated proof.
Of
That's the whole point.
Do.
No, we don't. We have a certificate of live birth, which,
well,
as you know, is
Sarah
not
Palin's.
A birth certificate.
Have you seen Sarah Palin's?
No, I haven't.
Okay,
I
all right.
You've got
all right.
Right.
It's
to
an open question.
You have every
as
right to ask for it.
Say, it's an open question.
I think you should post on her Facebook page tonight you want to see her birth certificate.
I will. Do you think she'll respond to me? I don't think so.
I think she will.
I think she has other people do that kind of thing.
All right.
Hey, you know who also has other people doing things they shouldn't be doing? Terrible segue, I know. The Salahis. We have, of course, the long blonde-haired woman dressed in her sari, and we have Tariq Salahi in his tuxedo, and they waltz right in. And you know what really galls me? Not that they did it. I mean, it's wrong, and the Secret Service should protect the president, and obviously they should stop this kind of thing. What galls me is the media talking about it again and again and again, and you admitted to me before the show you're a bit obsessed with it.
You know, Mark, I confess, we all have weaknesses, and the Salahi thing is one of mine. Only because, and yes, the Secret Service was horribly remiss.
They were.
Heads need to roll. The Salahis actually need to be prosecuted. Because,
I agree with you.
Because there's two jokes you don't make in this country. You don't go through airport security and talk, make jokes about bombs.
That's right.
And you don't crash parties at the White House uninvited. And
I
for
agree.
Those things, they need to go to jail.
I agree.
But
and
I'm
all
fascinated.
The secret people that came in with Dick Cheney that apparently he never talked about, if they were crashing, then they need to be prosecuted.
I'm fascinated by it because I spent a lot of time in Virginia wine country. As you know, the Salahis own a winery.
Did you go to their polo tournaments?
I have not been to their polo tournaments, but I was at their winery last week. I did ask a few questions of people, etc.
What did they say?
I met Tariq Salahi's father, who is not well. He's actually experiencing some very significant health issues. I did not meet his mother. I talked to all their friends. I got all the story. I have yet to have a chance to talk to Tariq and Mikhail. I look forward to that opportunity.
As far as I'm concerned, their 15 seconds of fame were up 15 days ago, and I wish we wouldn't talk about it at all. But I also confess to the weakness of reading some of those articles. But I hate myself for it, okay? I hate myself for it because I don't think they should have any fame from that.
I think less of myself as well.
And speaking of fame, I wish Tiger Woods had kept with his first comment, which was no comment. It's none of our business. That's another thing I wish the media wouldn't focus on. We've got Copenhagen and Afghanistan, and they're focused on Tiger Woods and the Salahis.
Mark, we have the right to ask any questions we want of Tiger.
No, we don't.
And he has
He's
the
a
right,
private citizen.
He has the right to give us any answer he wants, which is go fish.
That's
but
right.
the
and
fact
he should
of
have
that
stuck
is,
with that response.
Well, you know
no
what?
No comment.
This is the worst handled public relations thing I've ever seen
and
in my life.
Sometimes the smartest thing to do is to say no comment. He's not an elected official. He shouldn't have said anything at all. Mike Lane, I'm glad to hear what you had to say, even though I disagree with you most of the time. Thanks for coming here on the
Welcome to America.
Sarah Palin's a Canadian.